Hi, I'm Jim Gerson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grizzlies Podcast, episode 156. Gerson, you are back from Sundance with your hot tub parties with models and dogs wearing sunglasses.
Yes.
And all of your glides down the slopes. I'm not going to ask you. Sorry, I didn't like that sound last week. So my question to you, we don't have to talk about your parties because I'm sure you're just still hungover.
I am still wrecked, bro.
Having the glass of wine waved under your nose and then down the head goes
on the
table.
That was definitely, yes.
So just tell me, I'm sure we'll talk about this movie eventually, but I do want to know, what was the best movie that you saw at Sundance?
We may not end up actually talking about it. My favorite film was Michael Jackson documentary, Leaving Neverland. This is the second straight year that the best film I saw at Sundance was number one, a film about abuse and survivors of abuse. And number two is the second straight year that the film will be on HBO and not get a theatrical release. But yes, the
grumble.
Yeah, but this one was a little less surprising because it had already been established that it was going to air on HBO in the US, probably end of March is what I'm hearing. And then in the UK, I think it's on Channel 4 in the UK, but it's going to be on television. It's a two-part, overall four-hour documentary series where Dan Reed, this filmmaker, interviewed two men who in their childhood were befriended by Michael Jackson, and they tell their stories. We also hear stories from their families, friends, loved ones, their wives, and like that. And it is incredibly devastating, and it's sad. And, you know, a lot of people have asked me, is it too hard to watch? It's not a fun watch, and it's a difficult watch, but I think it actually justifies the 4 hours. It's going to be over 2 days on HBO, and I think that if people watch the first half, if they watch the first half, they should stick with it, because I think the second half is actually even better than the first half, and it goes in places and goes in directions I wouldn't necessarily expected. But it's really, really tremendous.
All right. What's it called again?
It's called Leaving Neverland.
Leaving Neverland. All right. Well, so that's kind of confusing, because isn't there an Oscar-nominated movie named Finding Neverland?
One of the fun things in the build-up to Sundance was people incorrectly calling it Finding Neverland. I'm sure the Finding Neverland searches on like IMDb and other places like went through the roof.
Spiked.
Yeah, right. Like, even at the festival, people kept incorrectly calling it Finding Neverland. But yes, it is called Leaving Neverland. Dan Reed is the director. But I haven't finished it yet, but I will have my usual ranked list of everything. Yes. I saw at Sundance on my site. By the time this podcast goes up, it will be on my site.
All right, so number one on your list from Sundance is Leaving Neverland, and number two is Jacuzzi with Sunglass Dog.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, like health-wise, if that's such a good idea to have the sunglass-wearing dog in the jacuzzi with all the babes and everybody else, but that's the way it turned out.
That's just the way, you know what? That's the type of that's how wild parties end up in Sundance. Just inevitably, it's just dogs and sunglasses in the jacuzzi.
I love that just like a movie trope is this party was so crazy. How crazy was it? Like a dog did something crazy? Like it's always exactly. Like a dog. There's rarely a cat. It's usually like the dog is doing something nuts. Like the dog did cocaine.
The cat
it's like something like cocaine. That. That's always the sign that your party, if you want to know if your party was a success, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to this here podcast, is the dog wearing sunglasses, drinking booze, or doing cocaine? That's how you know it's a good party.
I feel like it's been a plot point in like three of the last four movies involving John Travolta and or Tim Allen that a dog has done Viagra.
Yeah.
I just think that's happened.
Yes.
I just think
cut you dog reaction shot.
What? Ooh. Boy, I get yelled at when I just lay there. Anyway, this is the Grizzly. That's a little Weekend at Bernie's joke for you. This is the Grizzly Podcast, episode 156. Remind you, as always, go follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. We are on Instagram. We are on Facebook. And you can email us, Grierson Leach.
Your pronunciation is getting worse every week. This is terrible.
I know, I'm sorry. I may be having a stroke. email us at GriersonLeach@gmail.com. Go to our website, GraceUnleashed.com. Go to GraceUnleashed.com/RSVP. You see a list of every single movie we've talked about on this here podcast. The opening songs from Dylan Mayer on Cuthbert Avenue. Find it on Bandcamp and SoundCloud. Closing songs from My Friend Mary. Beyond the short songs on Melancholy Longings Facebook page of My Friend Mary. We still have a t-shirt. Grayson, what's the site for the t-shirt again?
It's conbureau.com. I wore my t-shirt at Sundance. I had dinner with some friends. Somebody wanted to get humped. Somebody, because a friend of mine who I had dinner with is a big fan of the podcast. Hi, Leslie. It's Tim.
I wore the shirt to show off.
But yes, it is. It's warm. It's lovely. It's comfortable. You don't necessarily end up humping people, but if you want to and want to wear the shirt, that's fine.
CottonBureau.com. Type in Grayson Leach, CottonBureau.com. We've got a link. I don't know, somewhere. Subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to find every single movie we've talked about this here podcast is to subscribe to us on iTunes/Apple Podcasts. And if you do, and leave us the name of a movie you would like us to discuss on the podcast, we will discuss it in our reboot section. This week's reboot request comes to us from NatureNick17 from August 6th, 2018. NatureNick17 writes, like chatting with two good friends at the bar. 5 stars, of course, we all know, as I've established, you could chat with me at the bar, but Grissa would smell your drink and...
That's exactly right. I'm like, alcohol, I don't care for that. That's what
it's not that you don't care. You just get a whiff of it and...
I forgot what the conceit of the joke was. Please continue.
Let's go with that. Yes. Even though I've never met either of them in real life, it feels like I'm good friends with Tim and Will, as both of them often talk about how much they like to spend time with the characters in movies. The hour or so I spend with these two every week is always worth it. They speak intelligently about movies, but they don't come across as pretentious, and I've been introduced to dozens of new movies through them. For the reboot, please review the 1960 Stanley Kramer film Inherit the Wind. So in our reboot section, we will be discussing Inherit the Wind. However, Grayson, we're going to we have one new movie to discuss, and then we're doing a little special. We've got this request from a lot of people where we would like take a look at a filmmaker's career in like a macro sense. Maybe when they've got a new release about to come out, like for example, what we're doing now. We're going to try that this week. It may not work. See if you guys like this. Let us know, GraysonLeach@gmail.com, to let us know if you like this conceit. But what we're going to do is after we do our first review, we're going to have a sit and we're going to have a discussion of the career of Steven Soderbergh, who has a movie coming out next week called High Flying Bird on Netflix and in theaters, apparently. So we're going to have a discussion of Steven Soderbergh. So we're just going to talk about like his career, his best movies, what we think is interesting about him, and so on. We'll see if this works. I don't know how it's going to work. It's weird. This is 156 podcasts. You know what, Chris? I'm never afraid to try something new.
That's one of the things I love about you. You are bold. You're innovative. You'll try stuff.
That is not true. I've become a very old man that does not like to leave this desk ever.
We had a lot of people. I'm not aware of this. We have a lot of people saying, like, clamoring for us to. Because we also...
People like that. People like this idea. Yeah. I agree. I like the idea, too, because, you know, when you follow filmmakers... We just talked about 25th Hour, and we have like a long history with Spike Lee and how much we enjoy his movies. We both interviewed Spike Lee, and he's one of the people that got us both excited about movies in the first place. So like Spike Lee is someone I'd love, like you can have like a full rich conversation about his best movies, his worst movies, his style and all the things. So we're going to try it with Steven Soderbergh this week and see how it works. But before we get to that, we're going to discuss the one new movie of this week. And that new movie, which is also on Netflix and in a couple of theaters in, I believe, New York and Los Angeles, that movie is... Velvet Buzzsaw.
I'm quite curious to know what you think.
I think sober hasn't been good for him.
Pierce was in the full bloom of alcoholism here.
Exactly.
Never should have quit drinking.
No originality. No courage. My opinion.
I can't save you.
Velvet Buzzsaw is written and directed by Dan Gilroy, who, as we discovered from the internet, this week, does not know how to pronounce the word melancholy, which was very funny. Did you see that clip, Grayson?
I don't know what you're talking about, so I'm very intrigued by this.
Oh, it's very, very amusing. Look that up. It's very amusing. He's doing like a press junket with the cast, and he says melancholy, and Jake Gyllenhaal is is appalled. It's very amusing to watch how appalled Jake Gyllenhaal is by the fact, by how badly Dan Kilroy pronounces melancholy. I recommend it to everybody out there. But fortunately, that word does not come up in this movie. So I'm appreciative of that as someone that writes all the time, but doesn't know how to pronounce a lot of words. I'm sympathetic to Dan Kilroy, while also found Jake Gyllenhaal's reaction very amusing. Anyway, this is this movie stars Jake Gyllenhaal, as for the aforementioned, as the art critic. And boy, this is a movie that has a lot of funny names. Jake Gyllenhaal plays an art critic named Morph Van de Walt. Morph. It's Morph on Art. That's what this movie should have been called.
Oh, if anybody in the audience recognizes that deep cut reference, congratulations, you're as old as us. Congratulations.
Yeah. Boy. People love the Conway humor. Morph on Art. Morph Van de Walt is played by Jake Gyllenhaal. He is he's an art critic, and he's like very deep into the world of art, but also kind of troubled himself, has these kind of issues, Gyllenhaal's kind of been doing a lot lately, plays him very big and plays him in this kind of like very affected kind of way. He has a friend named Josephina, who played by Zoe Ashton, who I've never seen before. I thought she was pretty good in this. And then also there is Redora Hayes, played by Renee Russo, who is the wife of Dan Gilroy. They are all art people. There's also Toni Collette. And then there are two artists, one played by David Diggs, the other played by John Malkovich. This is the movie starts with basically this look at the art world. This is satire of the art world. And I don't really know a lot about art personally. I really don't even understand it. It's like poetry. Like, I respect that people can do it, but I can't. I don't even really understand it at all. I'm kind of a dullard and miscreant and an idiot in that regard. I regret and apologize for nothing. But nevertheless, it's kind of a funny, like kind of a light, funny satire of kind of art people and how like they're obsessed with commerce and so on. But then something strange happens. Josephina finds in her apartment building, discovers that one man has died, and his name is Vitral Dees. And that's that kind of movie. There's lots of different funny names in this movie. He dies, and she goes into his apartment and discovers these incredible paintings, these absolutely jaw-dropping, like affecting, disturbing, unbelievable paintings. And she decides that after kind of lying about how she said she found them in the dumpster, they're just going to be thrown out. She ends up like kind of to help her career going. She works for a neighbor who had just gotten yelled at that day. They decide to all sell them together because they're all in these incredible things. Well, while as it turns out, the aforementioned Vitral Dees maybe have put something in his paintings that makes them attack people. And I think Morph, the aforementioned Morph on Art, kind of goes and kind of investigates Dees's life, learns some very disturbing things about him. And suddenly, we are no longer in an art satire. We are in a horror film, and it is that kind of movie. Velvet Buzzsaw, I have to say, I don't think this movie really has a lot to say about art. I'm not an expert on art. There's a few kind of passing points about art and commerce and how people are, they will do anything they don't really care about the art. They just care about the money, which doesn't really strike me as a particularly deep concept when it comes to either art or movies or music or journalism or literally anything in the world that involves money and also some artistry to it. I don't think that Gilroy's trying to do anything new with that. I think he has his idea, and his idea basically is, here are paintings that come to life and kill you. And he's attached it to an art satire that I think is kind of a little like maybe lightly cutting about the idea of art and commerce, but really, it's just an excuse, I would argue, to come up with some, I think, kind of inventive ways for big stars to be killed by paintings. And so I think this movie is very silly. I think it is very kind of over the top. Again, the lead character, his name is Morph Van de Walt. I would argue Jake Gyllenhaal, in a movie like this where it's kind of hard to care about some of these characters, I would argue Gyllenhaal, Okja being the best example of this, Gyllenhaal maybe dials it up a little bit too high for me. Okja is the ultimate example. He plays this character very big, but I do think he actually, of all the characters, of all the actors, he actually finds a little bit of a core to this character and finds something interesting about him. Otherwise, I don't think the movie really cares or tries all that much. I don't think the movie has a lot to say. I still find it kind of entertaining. I still kind of enjoy it. I just like the idea. The movie, here's a half of an art satire, and here is a half of a horror movie. And it basically turns into Scream. any kind of horror movie we watch, people kind of get picked off. At that level, I found myself enjoying it while thinking there maybe wasn't too much more to it.
Yeah, I liked it less. I have to say, Dan Gilroy is like a funny guy. This is his third film that he's written and directed, and I haven't liked necessarily any of them. He did Nightcrawler, then he did Roman J. Israel Esquire, and now he's done this. And all three of them, you know, you have to give him a lot of credit because they are original screenplays. They're not based on anything. They are all very sort of distinctive and peculiar ideas. And the fact that he wants to make movies like this, I, in theory, am supportive of and sort of championing the idea of a filmmaker who wants to do like original things. I saw this at Sundance, and he did not mispronounce melancholy at the screening I saw when he introduced the movie, but he said that he wanted to thank Netflix because this movie does not exist without Netflix. And, you know, I don't think this movie works, but there is something to be said for the importance of this movie's existence just to create more opportunities for original kinds of ideas like this that aren't going to be made by major studios anymore. It's just too weird. Even though it has big stars in it, it's just too weird. They can't get the financing for it, and Netflix is a type of place that can kind of swoop in and allow these types of films to exist. I don't think the movie is good, but I found myself kind of still being happy that it in fact exists. I think that once again, Dan Gilroy has done a really interesting job of depicting Los Angeles in sort of an interesting way. I think he, like with Nightcrawler and Roman J. Israel, there's a very sort of specific Los Angeles that he is chronicling in this film. One of the best LA jokes in the movie for people who live there is one of the, it doesn't narrow it down to describe his character as pretentious, but Billy Magnuson's character who works at the gallery where Rene Russo's gallery, and he tells another character about the Broad Museum and says, it's not broad, though it looks like that, because it looks like broad, like the Broad Museum, the Broad Museum downtown looks like broad, it's broad. It's type of like insidery kind of LA pretentious art thing that somebody would try to say to impress somebody else. My problem is a couple things. Number one, I think that this movie has actually like kind of nothing to say about the art world. I think it's actually, and for me, that's more than the fact that there's nothing to say, because I think that the horror stuff that happens in the second half of the movie, and Gilroy has kind of said this in interviews, that the second half of the movie is in some ways supposed to be a karmic comeuppance for what the characters are like in the first half of the movie. They are getting what is coming to them because of how they are and how they treat art and how they think about art and like that. But I really could not care less about any of these characters. This is not Okja level bad, but I don't want to be this guy, but I'm going to be this guy for a second. When Jake Gyllenhaal's character is introduced into the film, the obvious response I think the audience is supposed to have is two things. Number one, he seems like a pretentious, you know, jerk. And number two, is he supposed to be gay? And I feel like, and we find out that he is bisexual, and I just found myself irritated by the fact that that character is bisexual, because it seemed to conjure up unflattering portrayals of certain types of people, and that if he's supposed to be someone we're supposed to kind of mock and scorn, having him also be gay as part of it just felt a little too much for me. It just kind of bugged me. And then the other thing is that while I do think some of the horror stuff is kind of great, once again, I tell you, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, if there is a hole, do not put your arm into it. I don't care what it is. No, don't do that. Some of that stuff actually is pretty inventive, but there's just not much. I don't think this movie is smart enough. I don't think it's funny enough. I don't think it's clever enough. It's my kind of problem with Dan Gilroy in general, where I just feel like there are ideas that are kind of interesting, but he thinks that they are more interesting than they in fact are. And while the movie is unpredictable, I could not say at any point during this movie that I knew where it was going, and there's some fun in that. It just seemed to me so kind of self-indulgent and also kind of self-congratulatory that after a while, there wasn't enough for me to kind of cling to. If you want to tell me that Toni Collette and Rene Russo play characters in the art world who are kind of vain and arrogant and just kind of like horrible people, that to me is not exactly shocking or new. To me, it just felt like maybe there's a reason why a studio wouldn't want to make this, because the ideas themselves in this film are not good enough. So I just couldn't get there.
I get it. Like, there is a lot of, like, I don't, this is not a great art satire. I do think it's kind of a pretty fun horror movie. I will say, like, that was enough for me. I find the way that he finds kind of new ways for these people to die clever. I thought it was actually, like, as a horror movie itself, I think it does kind of work. And it's a horror movie that's kind of got one foot in and one foot out, which I agree can be a little bit frustrating. I totally understand that. But I didn't mind, because at a certain level, I'm not going to blame the guy for just kind of screwing around a little bit. I would have probably disliked this movie more if it really acted like it had something deep to say about the art world. I don't think it does, other than just to, like, give him, like, a raspberry or, like, a Bronx cheer or something. Like, yeah, screw off. Maybe that's not enough, right? Like, maybe that's just glib to just be able to do that and move on with it. But I thought it was kind of fun. I kind of like the idea. I also think there's a couple touches that I kind of like. I like that the paintings do seem, like, kind of legitimately disturbing. I also like that David Diggs character, like, the David Diggs character and the John Malkovich character are actually not really satirized. They're just artists. They're the ones that, like, kind of appreciate the brilliance of that. I could see how that would drive some people off, because it's a little bit like, in a movie that was more strident, it'd be like, oh, art against commerce. I just don't think he cares that much. He's just jerking around. And I understand why that it falls on that knife's edge. Certain filmmakers, when they jerk around like this, I'll be like, go away. Like, come back when you have something to say. And I understand that, and I'm probably not intellectually consistent about it. But I found this movie just silly enough that I kind of went along with it.
Yeah, I think for me, if I had laughed more or been more kind of engaged by it, but to me, it's just so kind of lazy in certain ways, in terms of like the content of it and the things it's, again, I think the movie is trying to say certain things that after a while, I just think it's easy. It's easy to go, man, those are people, am I right? I mean, there's fewer things that are, like, easier to do in terms of, like, doing a us versus them kind of thing in a movie than that. And so that didn't entirely work for me. Yeah,
I wish you liked Gyllenhaal more. I understand what you're saying, but that character does get a little bit more interesting as it goes along. I'm not sure that Rene Russo does, and I'm not sure the assistant does, but I do think the Gyllenhaal character, there's a little bit more going on. Maybe it's just from the actors, from the actor putting something into it. But it does feel like that character deepens when maybe some of the other characters don't.
No, I think he does deepen a little bit, but he's also the character who's like, I have more exposition to tell you because I've done more research into the background of this whole thing. But I agree that of the three of them, he is the most well-drawn. But still, it felt like it was not that hard for him to go from the most, callous, arrogant jerk to, wait a second, there's this thing going on. We don't need to talk about Okja anymore. I hate that performance. Like, all in terms of, like, recent years, I think it's one of the worst performances from a very good actor, because I think he is a very, very good actor. I think sometimes his choices are just too broad and don't work. This is not as bad as that, but to me, it still felt caricaturish in a way that seemed, again, kind of easy and reductive. When the character gets deeper as the film goes along, yes, I agree that that happens, but it's kind of a low bar at that point, so it didn't exactly sort of impress or surprise me. And also, I just think that while the movie, I think, is more about the people around the art world, I think it's also kind of about, like, and again, I think a very easy joke. Boy, isn't postmodern art kind of dumb? Like, they do the joke of, is this thing a piece of art or is it just, like, furniture? You don't know in this modern art world. I always find that really just kind of, it just kind of bugs me. I don't know that world at all either, but it always, to me, seems like such a simplistic way especially, and I'm sorry, if you're a filmmaker who lives in Los Angeles and has a certain amount of, like, cachet and the ability to cast the actors that you do, to pretend that postmodern art is so beyond your simple guy understanding, I don't know, that just seems, like, completely disingenuous in a way that I don't entirely trust and find kind of annoying. It's so, for me, those things were enough to kind of keep me from some things I think are sort of interesting, and some of the ways that this movie is shot and the way the story is told. It's funny because I think all three of his films, I think, are all really interesting. They just don't work for me. And it includes Nightcrawler, which I think is the one movie that people generally like of his. I've always felt like they just don't entirely work. This is, I think, the weakest of his three movies.
Like this, probably less than the other two. I don't think any of them are great, but I think he's fine. Like, I understand your criticisms are noted and understood. Like, I don't necessarily disagree. I just think that, like, come on, there's some fun stuff in this movie, and it is well acted. And I wish Toni Collette had, like, a lot more to do. Right? Like, it's Toni Collette. Like, have you seen her scream? Like, she's an incredible screamer. Give her some screams, for crying out loud.
She is. I won't spoil this for people who haven't seen it. She is connected to the legitimately funniest joke, I would say, in the movie. And I think that joke, I think you know what I'm talking about, that I think speaks to the movie that this could have been, that's a little sharper, and instead it's just a little too lazy for my taste.
Fair enough. All right, so what did you give it?
I give it a C.
I'm a B minus. I'm a B minus on this. It was enough for me, but I get it. I understand. I'm down. I'm with you. All right, so now we're going to try a little Soderbergh discussion.
Generic greeting.
Generic greeting returned.
Imminence, sustenance.
Overly dramatic statement regarding upcoming meal.
Ooh, false reaction indicating hunger and excitement.
My favorite, I'm going to start with my Steven Soderbergh story, by the way. This is one of my favorite Steven Soderbergh stories. This is my interaction with. Have you ever met Steven Soderbergh?
No, I've never met him. No.
So it was 2004, and I was with my girlfriend at the time. She was a writer, and she had, like, I think she we were in Times Square. She had met with her agent or something, and I was meeting with her afterward. And it was pouring down rain, so we ducked into, like, an Irish pub, and there was nobody there. It was like 3:30 in the afternoon, and it was on, like, a Tuesday. and for whatever reason, I go in there, and there's this dude at the bar, and I lean over to my girlfriend, and I say, that really looks like Steven Soderbergh. But why would Steven Soderbergh at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Tuesday be sitting alone in an Irish pub in Times Square, not drinking? It was like a glass of water in front of him. And so I looked at more and more, because we're just trying to stay out of the rain. And look more and more at him, and find, like, you know what? God damn, I think that's Steven Soderbergh. And so I couldn't, because there's nobody else in the bar, nobody in there. I'm just come over and say, listen, I just want to know I'm a big fan of your films. I'll let you go to your water. I just want to know I'm a big fan. And I go over that, and I say not only that, but, like, I even own your book, which is his book, Getting Away With It, which is basically his conversations with, what's the filmmaker he has those conversations with?
Richard Lester,
thank you. It's his conversation with Richard Lester when he's making Schizopolis. I was like, I even own your book. And he said, why? That is what he said to me. And I said, I don't know. I just like it. He's like, cool. Well, thank you. He's very, very nice. But that, like, there's something very Soderbergh-ian about the idea that of him being in there on a Tuesday, right out of nowhere, of all, like, this is a nowhere Irish bar. He wasn't drinking. Maybe he was staying out of the rain too. But I just thought that was kind of amazing that Steven Soderbergh, of all things, was just sitting alone in a bar on 3:30 on a Tuesday afternoon. It seems, I don't know, it just seems, I don't know how he had time to do it with all the media he consumes every year, because he, of course, has that list at the end of the year. So Soderbergh, to me, is one of my favorite, my overarching theory of Soderbergh, and I wrote about this for Deadspin a few years ago when he had supposedly retired, was about to retire, which is there, every single time I see the Soderbergh movie, by the way, this is in to celebrate, I guess, High Flying Bird, which comes out next week. We are going to review that on the podcast, so we're not going to discuss it here. So this is a general warm up to Soderbergh discussion. And my overarching theory of Soderbergh is, I think there's been a couple movies he's made that have not been good, but they're always interesting. Every single movie he makes is always interesting. There's always something to it. And there's always something he brings to it that's probably not there otherwise. That is the great part of Soderbergh. And that's why I almost always enjoy every single one of his movies. Part of that, however, I think there's something about Soderbergh Maybe this is a kind of his generation. Maybe this is a Gen X thing. But there is something about Soderbergh that always feels slightly removed from the material, which is often like what makes the movies great. Like, a lot of times you can feel Soderbergh kind of like sitting beside you as you watch the movie, kind of like nudging, like, hey, check this out. And it's kind of fun. There's a little remove to it. There's always kind of a good vibe to him. But I would also argue that that is ultimately has so far anyway put a ceiling on his movies in that, other than maybe Che, it's hard to find a movie where he just goes all in, where he has a Werner Herzogian or a Scorsese sort of deep, passionate, over the top. This is, I'm putting everything in my, every single part of my emotion into this movie. He's too postmodern. He's too kind of a deconstructionist. I think Schizopolis is probably the purest sense of, purest view of his sensibility as that crazy ass movie that he made, which I actually really enjoy. But like, I feel like because of that, I always like his movies, and he's just a natural filmmaker. But I do wonder if in a macro sense, whether in that he's almost stands back too far and is too removed to make a truly, truly great, great, great movie, because he's just not that kind of filmmaker.
Yeah, when we did our Vulture rankings a couple years ago, we're going to update those here in a bit. You know, we in the intro, that was saying that we talked about this idea that he's, what was the phrase, a genius without a masterpiece. And I think that there is something to be said for that. You know, this is not the only way to measure a filmmaker's greatness and importance and cultural legacy, blah, blah, blah. But when you think about like the every 10 years Sight and Sound critics poll of the greatest movies ever made, what you often see in that on those lists is you have to have a movie where people go, that's the one. That's the movie. That is their movie. That they are not only a great filmmaker, but they have made an indisputably great film. And to be clear, I think we're both saying the same thing. It's not that Soderbergh hasn't made great films, because he's made many of them, but he hasn't made a movie where people look at and go, that was the best movie of the last 10 years, or the century, or the last 15 years, or the decade, or whatever. His movies have a certain kind of, they're not flip, but there's almost a certain sense of, this is fun. I think I'll do one of these. And that is different than, say, making a, for right or for wrong, how we think about these things, making a Vertigo or a Schindler's List or one of those kinds of movies. It feels like it comes from that person's heart and soul, is ripped out of them, and no other human being on the face of the earth could make that movie. Now, Soderbergh movies are very distinctive. They're very much him. But I think we tend to value the idea of this person is communicating something deep and painful or obsessive in their personality, and we are receiving it and getting some sort of like window into their soul. That's why people love somebody like Scorsese and love something like Raging Bull, because we feel like somehow he is communicating something sort of torturous within themselves. We think of that as those are the great movies. That's, you know, those are masterpieces. Soderbergh just doesn't work that way. That's not his style. Maybe his movies are very personal to him, but they don't communicate in that kind of way. And in some ways, I think what's interesting about Soderbergh as a filmmaker is that he kind of creates a counter argument to the idea of, if you don't do a Vertigo, if you don't do a Raging Bull, if you don't do a Schindler's List, if you don't do something that is, for lack of a better way of describing it, important in those ways, does that make you less important of a filmmaker? I don't think necessarily, but I think in terms of like legacy and sort of way, the way we measure Soderbergh, that is held against him. Those are things that look, we look at him and go, well, yes, but he's never made this kind of, he's never made a There Will Be Blood. That's not the type of movie that he seems interested in making, but those are the movies we look at. Like, he hasn't made a Zodiac. He hasn't made those kind of films.
Yeah, and that's, and again, this is not a criticism, and I wonder if he did, probably the closest he's tried to come was Che, right? Like the Che Guevara movie, it kind of drove him crazy when he made it. It was just like this massive, massive endeavor. They put that in two parts, but I only saw, when I saw it in one straight run with an intermission. Is that how you saw it? Did you see it in two
parts? I saw it with an intermission at a screening, yeah, that's how I did it.
And I thought the movie was really good and really impressive, but it felt, I don't know, it's weird. Ironically, I felt like this feels like still kind of impersonal. It feels like him, like, trying to make one of those without necessarily feeling like he was deeply invested. And maybe he's not deeply invested in anything, which is fine, which is very Gen X, actually, is that kind of idea. And, you know, when I think of, like, the pivot movie for him, everybody has a pivot movie. We talk about Tarantino. Tarantino's pivot movie is probably Jackie Brown, right? Like, that was the movie where you hit a certain level. Which direction is he going to go after this? And he went a certain way. I feel like Soderbergh, that movie is actually Schizopolis. Because, remember, Sex Lies and Videotapes comes out. It is this massive, he is the brilliant genius, this incredible artist, and he changes independent film, and all of these things happen. And he kind of chafes under that, right? And he makes kind of like these deliberately difficult movies. He makes Kafka. He makes these movies that are somewhat impenetrable in a lot of ways, and definitely not they're not movies that feel like, think about Paul Thomas Anderson when he makes Magnolia. Like, I don't think Magnolia is a great, great movie. I like it a lot, but I don't think it's great. And certainly, I think that could actually be a pivot movie for him, actually. But after Boogie Nights is this big hit, he's like, oh yeah? Well, check out this. And for better or worse, that movie is deeply felt and is clearly Paul Thomas Anderson saying, I'm taking a big, huge freaking swing. And Soderbergh doesn't do that after Sex, Lies, and Videotape. He kind of makes these smaller movies that are kind of difficult, and they don't really work, and they're not, and nobody sees them. And so he finally comes across Schizopolis, which he's apparently going through a divorce at the time, and he casts himself, and the movie is just like banal conversations and weird rabbit holes and all this meta postmodern junk that some of it I find very, very funny, but it's clearly, that's as close to a deeply personal movie that he makes. And how personal is it? It's all just a deconstruction of an actual movie in which there's a 5-minute scene where he just sits and makes funny faces in a mirror. Like, it is as masturbatory of a movie as you have. I find that fun because he's such an incredible craftsman. He's got so many ideas. But I think that movie, after that, he makes Out of Sight. And then he kind of goes through that run where he makes Out of Sight and Aaron Brockovich and Traffic. And he's like, look, I can make these big, successful movies that are also smarter and through the Hollywood system. And then he shifts off from that and goes off in another direction. It's weird, though, because that, to me, is like a mark of an artist, right? A guy that keeps trying new things. Remember when he did Bubble, it was like, what? This movie's going to be released on video is the same day as theaters? What kind of madness is Soderbergh doing? He's always kind of trying new things in a way that we generally want from our artists. But unfortunately, I also feel because of that, everything sometimes feels like a doodle, a great doodle, and often incredible doodles, but they still kind of feel like doodles.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've never interviewed him, so I would love to know the answer to this. But there is a feeling from, especially like some of the things post-retirement, or even right before he retired, and then in fact did not retire, that there was sort of a sense of, I'd like to do one of these, I'll do this now. You know, I want to do like a psychological horror movie, I'll do one of those with Unsane. Or I want to do this kind of like sexy erotic thriller with a lot of weird juicy twists, I'll do Side Effects. Like, there is a idea of him kind of experimenting and trying things. And it is harder and harder to for that to be marketable, first of all. I mean, what he's discovered with both Unsane and Logan Lucky is that, you know, it's hard to make money in terms of actually getting an audience to see those movies. And that's kind of discouraging in a way. I mean, in terms of pivots, I agree, because I feel like Schizopolis going into Out of Sight, I still remember when that movie came out, and there was sort of a sense of, well, you know, Soderbergh, he used to be really great, but, you know, it's like Soderbergh used to be really great, but now who knows? And Clooney, he's this guy who's on this TV show, but, you know, that Batman movie was terrible, so maybe he's kind of he can't make the leap from television to film, and Out of Sight is this happy surprise that comes out of that. But, you know, for me, like, the thing that is, I don't know if it's his most heartfelt or from the heart or whatever, but to me, like, Traffic is the movie that I actually went back and rewatched it a few years ago when I did my book of interviews with screenwriters. I was going to interview Stephen Gagan, who wrote Traffic and won the Oscar for it. And so I wanted to watch Traffic again before I talked to him. And I was just really impressed. Like, it feels, it actually feels sort of full-bodied in a way that sometimes his movies do not. And, you know, even like I was saying, like with Aaron Brockovich, which I think is actually a really successful movie, there is still an element of, just so you know, I'm making this type of movie. And I feel like what is good and what is really kind of rich about Traffic is that it's one of the few times, I mean, I would put it down to like Traffic and my own kind of like pet, like passion project of his girlfriend experience, which I think is really exceptional. Those feel like movies that don't suggest that he's going, just so you know, I'm making this kind of movie. They actually feel like the movies he is trying to make, as opposed to him commenting on them. Even the Oceans movies, which I find very entertaining, still kind of want you to know that they're the movies that he's trying to make. They always kind of like nudge you just a bit so that you are aware of it. Traffic, to me, is the one movie that really feels like, it actually feels emotional in a way that a lot of his movies do not feel emotional. I mean, it's sort of Altman-esque in certain ways, but it actually, you actually do feel things from that movie, even though it's still as restrained as his movies normally are. And I think in some ways we've kind of just gotten used to the idea that Soderbergh is a guy who is just going to do his own thing. I mean, you keep mentioning the Gen X thing, Will. I think about the fact that, like, in some ways he is like the musician who's going to do like the weird side project just because he wants to. He'll like record with a couple of his buddies under a different name or a different kind of band name, and he'll do that, and then he'll do like a proper album in a couple years, or maybe he'll do this. He's always going to do something interesting, and he's really not going to worry so much about what's going on in terms of the overall kind of marketplace. And there aren't a lot of filmmakers right now who have that. I don't know if he could start out that way now. I think because he has the reputation and the legacy he has, he can get away with that. But yeah, and that's impressive. I think in some ways, his spirit is almost more impressive than the movies themselves, which are pretty impressive on their own.
You talk about the girlfriend experience. I want to talk about our best movie, what I think his best movie is, and maybe what his most underappreciated movie is. I would say along Girlfriend Experience is definitely one of his unappreciated movies. I think that movie is incredible. And I would also argue another underrated movie is The Informant! Exclamation point. From 2009. It's been 10 years, Grierson, since The Informant came out, if that makes you feel that much older than we already do. Of course, that movie takes place in our neck of the woods. Yes. That the Mark Whitaker, who played by Matt Damon, is from Mowiqua, Illinois, which is the little town of 2,000 people where my mother grew up. And there are scenes in the movie that are filmed there. That and I feel like that movie, I was all excited about the movie because it took place, you know, in where we're from and in my mom's hometown. But that movie is, I think, as close to Soderbergh doing, like, it's hard to imagine. Like, that was a Hollywood movie, right? Like, that was like a studio movie. But it's crazy because it's such an undermining way to do that movie. It's such a strange way to do it in a way that's ultimately so affecting and actually makes the point the movie trying to make. Like, I'm sure, you know, Soderbergh talked about the idea of how much he loves the idea of an unreliable narrator. This is the ultimate unreliable narrator movie. And the idea that the narrator in that movie, you kind of like slowly see it, him kind of fall apart over voiceover. Like, that's the most Soderbergh thing ever, right? The idea of, you know what? The narrative that you think you're watching, it's actually starting to kind of crumble around you. And that's a clever little trick, but it also fits thematically with what the movie's about. I feel like The Informant is a movie that's not really talked about enough in kind of Soderbergh's great movies. All right, so two last things before we're going to close out on this. One, what would you consider the best Soderbergh movie? I'll tell you mine. I have to say, I move around this a lot. I go sometimes to Informant. I go sometimes to Girlfriend Experience. I sometimes go to The Limey, which I think works really well. The Ocean movies are great. I really feel like the purest distillation of what he's doing and where it works, I think it's probably Out of Sight.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember this. Well, actually, when I first saw Out of Sight, I thought it wasn't very good. I actually was sort of disappointed because I think I was expecting a different type of thing. And then I saw it a second time, and I was like, no, this is clearly great. I had just sort of kind of missed the boat on it. It's not my favorite of his, though. I think I still would go with Traffic. So I think beyond what I said before about being so well-constructed and a ton of great performances, Harrison Ford, to the day he dies, will think, why did I not do that movie? Why did I let Michael Douglas take that role away from me? He didn't take it away. Harrison Ford basically just sort of dropped out of the project. I also think this still to this day, like the smartest look at the war on drugs. I mean, we've had these Sicario movies since then, other movies since then that have tried to kind of tackle the war on drugs from a lot of different angles. I think Traffic is still the best and the smartest and the saddest. And the British miniseries that is based on is also really good, but I actually prefer the movie. So Traffic to me is still the best thing that he's ever done. He won the directing Oscar for it. I think it's really, really great.
All right, so Soderbergh. So hey, let us know if you liked our little discussion of Steven Soderbergh and how it all worked out, if you thought it was fun. Maybe we'll do another filmmaker down the line. But for now, there's our Steven Soderbergh discussion. We'll be back next week to talk about High Flying Bird, which is his 30,000th movie. All right, so now we're going to our reboot movie. Our reboot movie this week is Inherit the Wind.
Can't you understand that if you take a law like evolution and you make it a crime to teach it in the public schools, tomorrow you can make it a crime to teach it in the private schools, and tomorrow you may make it a crime to read about it, and soon you may ban books and newspapers. And then you may turn Catholic against Protestant, and Protestant against Protestant, and try to foist your own religion upon the mind of man. If you can do one, you can do the other. Because fanaticism and ignorance is forever busy and needs feeding.
Inherit the Wind came out in 1960. It was based on a play turned into a movie. It stars Spencer Tracy as Henry Drummond. It's based on actual events, but the names have been changed. Henry Drummond is a, as we are informed often in the film, a Chicago lawyer who has come to a small town in Nebraska to represent a school teacher there who wants to teach about Darwin. But there is a law in the county or the state, I forget which now, that you are not allowed to teach evolution, only creationism. He refuses to do that. He teaches anyway. He is arrested. He needs a lawyer. Henry Drummond is going to represent him. For the prosecution, you have Matthew Harrison Brady, who is, of course, patterned after William Jennings Bryan, played by Frederick March. Funny fact, Spencer Tracy and Frederick March had both won two Oscars by this point. People know I feel like Spencer Tracy better. Frederick March, maybe not so much. He was terrific in Best Years in Our Lives. He's also great in Jekyll and Hyde from about 30 years before this. He is absolutely terrific in both of those movies. He plays Brady, who is very much a Bible Belt, conservative kind of blowhard lawyer who is going to prosecute this poor teacher. Covering the case, and if you've only seen his musicals, it is very strange to see him in this role, is Gene Kelly as Hornbeck, who is from the Baltimore Herald and is kind of smug and arrogant and kind of looks down his nose at these small town people and their small-minded kind of ways, and he's going to be reporting this story. And Inherit the Wind was nominated for 4 Oscars, didn't win any. That was the year The Apartment won Best Picture. And when we were on last week's episode of the podcast and we were talking about Inherit the Wind, which neither of us had seen at that point, I had told Will that I was concerned about this movie because it felt like the sort of kind of Oscar-y awards bait sort of drama that I don't necessarily love. And I have to say that my fears were confirmed. It is kind of that movie, but I think it still, in fact, works. It works well enough. It is very stagey. You can tell it's based on a play. And it's a type of movie where it's very clear that there are good guys and there are bad guys and there are good ideas and there are bad ideas, and that we in the audience are going to champion and root for the people who are defending the good ideas against the bad people who are trying to advocate the bad ideas. And in that way, it is very awards bait-y. And yet, I have to say that, you know, while Stanley Kramer is not a director who I think of as necessarily as scintillating, he is the type of guy who can do this material in a way that it is very solid. That's the word I kept like thinking as watching this movie. It is very solid. It is very worthy and noble. And I think Spencer Tracy works exceptionally well. Frederick March is pretty hammy in this. I think he is less effective. Gene Kelly is even a notch below that. You know, he was most known for musicals, obviously, but he also had a career as a dramatic actor that was not as distinguished. If you watch Inherit the Wind, you can kind of understand because he just doesn't come off correctly. There is something that's just sort of false about him in the role. Though he is supposed to play a somewhat slimy big city journalist, it still feels like it doesn't entirely work. Supporting cast is pretty decent. I liked Harry Morgan as the judge. I actually think he's pretty decent in this. But there is a reason why I think that this movie is not necessarily deeply respected as much as maybe say it's beloved by some people. It is a movie that is quote-unquote important because it's talking about the separation of church and state, the idea of advancing scientific knowledge over just sort of religious belief. Those things are still kind of relevant today, I would argue. This is not a great movie. It's good enough.
Yeah, it feels a little... We've talked before about documentaries, how we don't like it when at the end there's a, to get more information about this cause, please go to this website where you can support this cause. It feels a little like that, right? It's very, if you'll forgive the term, very preachy. It's incredibly preachy. And it is very certain of who is right and who is wrong. Harrison gets like a couple moments where Harrison Brady gets a couple moments where he gets to be a human, but they're very short lived. And there's a lot, particularly I think the end of this movie feels very dun dun dun. This is drama. And I get it.
Right. I couldn't hear you from all the people yelling at each other in the movie.
Yeah, there's like a lot of...
This is a movie that's very much like, I'm yelling louder than you to make the bigger point. It is very much that.
Yeah, and so I think I like Gene Kelly a little bit more than you do in this movie. He can't ever stop. I think he's supposed to be slimier and you're supposed to hate that character more, but it's Gene Kelly, so it's really hard. I do like his hat. I think you are automatically made like 15% more cynical. Uh-huh. Or more con man-esque if you're wearing that hat. But I think he's fine. I think Spencer Tracy's fine too, but it does feel like this is a movie that this is a movie of, to use a wrestling term, cheap heat. Like this is a movie that like really has a lot of, hey, you know who's awesome? Cleveland, we love you. And everyone goes, yeah. Like this is very much a movie where you really want the crowd to be like, yeah, see, we're right and you're right. And aren't we great? And it feels, I wish, like the townspeople are like the people running to burn Frankenstein in this movie, for crying out loud. And I feel like whatever. I am pro-creationism. I think it's correct. I think people that try to throw people in jail for teaching creationism are bad. I think those people are bad. I agree. I'm on their side. But it definitely feels very like, this movie's very backpatty in a lot of ways. It's funny, when I was looking up this movie, I read it and watched it, and I just thought, okay, I should research this a little bit. To have the fact that it came out in 1960, like, this movie feels like it came out in 1941, right? Like, it feels like it came out in the 40s. Like, this is the year that you talk about The Apartment. This is the year that Psycho came out. Like, this movie, like, I get the 1960 was not, like, the 70s heyday of Copeland's and Scorsese and all the run-through of that. But, like, 1960 is late enough to where interesting stuff was starting to happen. This is not like it's pre-code, still post-code, I suppose, but it's still like this movie feels like in 1960, it feels like a movie that people would have gone to and said, oh no, that's how you're supposed to make them. Like it's an old-fashioned movie in a time that feels it feels like it was an old-fashioned movie 60 years ago. Is probably the best way to put it. The idea this came out the same movie year, Psycho, and Psycho feels like a movie that is relevant and urgent and feels of the moment. This feels very musty.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to, you know, take shots at Green Book at this point, but it is sort of like, it's better than Green Book, but it's that type of thing where it's like, it's the type of movie that does well with Academy members or well enough to get four nominations that, you know, it's about things that they can all agree with, very easily, you know, performed by powerhouse actors giving powerhouse performances. It's that kind of, you know, like I said before, like, there's a lot of shouting. And not only are they shouting, there's like people in each other's faces acting loudly. Like there's a lot of loud acting kind of going on in this movie, and lots of like, you know, my dad is a lawyer, and he is, before we got on to record this episode, I told my dad that this week's episode was about Inherit the Wind, which he has never seen. It was before he became a lawyer. He's like, yeah, those are like lawyer movies where like stuff that's just not realistic at all. And he read the book. I watched the movie today, and I'm like, yeah, this is the type of thing that would drive my father crazy, because I don't know what the law was like in the early, I guess like 1920s is when this movie is set. It just seems like you can't do a lot of the things that happen in this movie in terms of like how you do it. Like, I just want to know how many times in real life court situations can you put the other lawyer on the stand? How often does that happen? Because it happens here. It's a thing that happens here. And it's just, I don't want to be condescending about this, but I'm trying to imagine that 1960 audience being like, well, this is most irregular. Like, that's Spencer Tracy. I hope he knows what he's doing. You know, there's a lot of just kind of like cheesy, stagey, overly dramatic kinds of things like that.
Well, we've watched 30 years of Law and Order now, right?
That is part of the problem. Like, honestly, I would also say, by the way, do you ever, journalist, do you ever get nostalgic or wish, Will, that you lived in a time where you could call in your stories like Gene Kelly does at one point during this movie, where he's like dictating to some like luckless loser on the other side who has to transcribe all your brilliance? Do you wish that you could have lived in that period of time?
I'll have you know, when I worked at the Daily Illini in the 90s, I once had to read over my, because we couldn't get our modem thing to work, so I had to read over the entire story to some poor freshman over the phone from like after a Wisconsin-Illinois game. So, and it's a shame too, because I even at the time, it's funny, I hadn't thought of this movie even at the time, but even when I originally read him the story, I felt like I needed to do it like a telegram. Like, Illinois, looking good out here against the Badgers, stop. Lou Henson pushing his Chargers in a three-man weave. Well, kind of felt like I needed to do that. And they're like, please stop doing that. I'm 17. Right. Please stop yelling in my ear.
Yeah, please don't do the old-timey voice at the same time.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm 17.
I don't get any of the references to which you are referring. You're referring to.
Big game for Shelley Clark. Stop. Ready, Clemens. Good steal early. Stop.
And yes, in case anybody who has seen this movie or watched along with us for this week's episode, is that Norman Fell at the end? I looked. It was. I was like, is that Norman Fell? It is. Us being good Midwestern boys that we are, when the WGN radio thing shows up, my heart swelled with joy. I was like, oh, I hope they're going to have a Cubs game on after this. It is. I was reading a review earlier today that referred to this movie as stolid. That's probably pretty accurate. That's the one word that needs to probably be used. You know, Dick York as the teacher. That's kind of funny, just because I think of him so much from Bewitched. It's sort of fun to see him. I also think he looks a lot like Jim Carrey. I've always thought that. I was thinking about that a lot while watching this movie. It is a movie that basically says small towns are terrible, religion is awful. Get to the big city as quickly as you can to get away from these hicks. I was sort of curious what the reception to this movie was at the time, because there's really like an anti small town thing going on in this film, and I'm sort of curious how that actually played with much of the country. So it is the movie I kind of feared it was going to be in a lot of ways, and not bad. I was entertained enough. I was engage enough with the material, but
I'm kind of with you. This felt, I'll put it this way, this movie felt more like work than I thought it was going to. Like, it's not quite entertaining enough to where I ever felt like, all right, I'm into this now. I never quite got there. All right, so that is Inherent the Wind. Very windy movie, to say the least. Lots of sweaty people. screaming and pounding the table.
Yeah, it was filmed in Hedo Vision, I think. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. All right, so that's our show this week. Good times, good show, good happiness. Let us know if you liked the Soderbergh thing or if you thought it was too navel-gazy, windy, if you will. It'd be kind of fun. So next week, we have three new movies to talk about, so no reboot next week. The first new movie we'll be talking about, we just discussed it, is Steven Soderbergh's High Flying Bird. It is directed, of course, by Steven Soderbergh, written by Terrell Alvin McCraney, who wrote Moonlight, which is kind of exciting. Stars Moonlight's Andre Holland, along with Zazie Beetz, Zachary Quinto, Kyle MacLachlan, Bill Duke. Nice to see Predator's Bill Duke in this.
It's how he identifies himself to new people.
I forgot about, by the way, another aspect of Steven Soderbergh that we did not talk about in the show. He is the cinematographer of this movie as Peter Andrews, and he's the editor of this movie as Mary Ann Bernard, because it was, of course, made on an iPhone. So that should be kind of interesting. Second new movie this week is The Lego Movie 2, the second part, directed by Mike Mitchell, written by our old pals Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, and of course the sequel to the much-beloved Lego Movie. The kids like the Lego Movie. The Lego Movie is this day. I always remember the Lego Movie. It's the first movie my son ever saw in a theater.
Oh, that's very cute. Yeah. I mean, did he like it?
I mean, he was like two. So he liked it. He liked it as much as anyone can like something when halfway through their dad had to wipe their ass. So yes. So I suppose he liked it that much.
I have no further questions. In fact, I may never have a question after that. Yes. That is, yes.
I'm sorry, Grierson, but like babies shit in their diapers and you have to change it, even if you're in a movie theater. It actually does have to be changed.
Yeah, nice. That's not a service they offer at the movie theater,
no,
though, right?
Those days are over. Wait for a while, though. You know, that surround a vision or the feel a vision, or they spray you with water and stuff that they're doing at theaters now. Maybe that's the next innovation. And our final, just a baby, I'll just shit in your face. All right.
anything to keep that theatrical audience alive.
Yeah. Yes. I have to say, there have been movies we've talked about in this podcast, like Warcraft, that felt like a movie, a baby shit in my face.
Yeah, Emoji Movie, that was definitely that kind of experience. Yes.
All right, and our last movie we'll be discussing this week is What Men Want. It's directed by Adam Shankman. It stars Teresa P. Henson and Richard Roundtree, Tracy Morgan, apparently Brian Bosworth, if I'm remembering the trailer correctly.
Wait, what? This is why Brian Bosworth is in the trailer. I miss out on this stuff. Now, yeah, Will, I'm confused. I remember that Mel Gibson was in a movie about 20 years ago called What Women Want.
Yeah, and because that movie solved that question so definitively, now it's time to find out what men want.
It only took us 20 years, but we have the answer for this as well.
yeah, exactly. So next week we'll be discussing three new movies: High Flying Bird, The Lego Movie 2, which I'll be viewing for Paste if you're looking for that this week, and What Men Want. Good show, Grierson. Nice stop. I'm back to Illinois. I'm back to our hinterlands of Illinois this week. I will be back home in both Mattoon and Soiling Young Minds at the University of Illinois Journalism Department in Champaign, Illinois.
I love that this podcast episode ended with two references to Soiling. That's very exciting.
I think this is going to be a new measure for when we really hate a movie, because people get mad at us when we don't give movies Fs. So we won't give a movie an F, but we'll say a baby shitting in your face bad.
that's our thing. My review for Lego Movie 2 is out already for Screen International, but I'm not going to say anything because you haven't seen it yet. And we have both already written about High Flying Bird, but we haven't discussed it or read the other person's thing. But our stuff is out there. So I have to go another week not knowing what you thought of High Flying Bird, Will. But we'll talk about it next weekend.
Well, guys, don't tell him. Nobody tell him. No. Don't just go treat and be like, he thinks it's like a baby shitting in his face.
Right. Yes. I appreciate our audience's consideration that they don't ruin these surprises for us, because that is part of the fun of the podcast, is us actually talking about it for the first time after we've seen the movie. So, and What Women Want, or I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to work to not call that movie What Women Want over and over again. That's my assignment to myself this week. Enjoy the Super Bowl, Will.
I keep calling it Finding Neverland.
Yeah, don't call it Finding Neverland. Don't call it. Everybody at Sundance called it Finding Neverland. Do not resist the urge. This movie has nothing to do with Johnny Depp.
Don't tell me to enjoy the Super Bowl, by the way, because I think this is going to be posted right before the Super Bowl. So just know, everyone listening, for the record, well, you're probably listening to this after the Super Bowl is over. Just know, I was actually rooting for the Patriots in the game because I have lived in St. Louis and cannot root for Stan Kroenke and the Rams.
Sorry. It is a terrible choice between two terrible options. As my old friend Rob would sometimes say, can the stadium just implode? That would be terrible. So many people would be hurt from that. But I, choosing between two evils, I am going to root for the Rams. But if they do win, I am leaving the party I'm going to before they have the championship trophy ceremony because I cannot watch that part. That will be too hard to watch.
All right, Grierson, have a good week. Everyone have a good week. We'll be back next week with High Flying Bird, The Lego Movie 2, and What Men Want. See you, Grierson.
Bye.
Bye.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works 'cause of us. And should anyone say different, it would.